You're listening to the Fresh Hell Podcast. Fresh Hell contains stories of a disturbing and often graphic nature and is intended for a mature audience. Please don't let your kids listen to this, or they might turn out like us. Hi, I'm Annie from the US.
And I'm Johanna in Austria, and you're listening to your favorite international podcast. Thank you for joining us again for yet another episode of the podcast that covers murder, mystery, and the macabre throughout history. It's the podcast hosted by two women on opposite sides of the Atlantic who never met in real life. And for all the other information on how to contact us, how to support this podcast, and how to join the Fresh Hell community, listen until the very end, because that's when we'll tell you all about that. Because now we want to jump right into today's topic.
One thing I want to mention very quickly is that we have a surprise foster dog. Surprise! It wasn't really planned, but a friend reached out because a dog that had been found dumped under a bridge with her babies. Her puppies were adopted. She was transported up to Massachusetts, or up to Rhode Island, actually, from Louisiana. And after all that, she was not adopted. And so if they couldn't find an emergency foster, she was going to have to get back in the van and go back to Louisiana after her quarantine. And obviously that wasn't going to happen. So we have Tallulah, the surprise foster dog, here, and she is an absolute delight, but she's just been through a lot, and she's very needy and learning things. So if you hear any heavy breathing, that's probably her trying to crawl into my skin. You might, it's not me. If you hear, like, she might be giving herself a bath later, again, not me. So just, there's a new dog here. If you hear her screaming in the background, like no one's been murdered, she's got some hound in her, and she's a sweet, sweet lady. So I'll be sharing some images of Tallulah, and apologies if you hear her. This is a very famous case, not only infamous in Australia, but all over the world, and there's a lot to talk about. So this is going to be a two-parter, and it's a cold case. But next week, we will talk about possible suspects and one man in particular who looks like a pretty good fit for being the man who was responsible for the disappearance of three children. We are, of course, talking about the tragic disappearance of the Beaumont children. Our main sources for this case are the books Searching for the Beaumont Children, Australia's Most Famous Unsolved Mystery, and The Satin Man, both by Alan J. Whitaker, as well as Unmasking the Killer of the Missing Beaumont Children, by Stuart Mullins and Bill Hayes, and of course many contemporary and modern newspaper articles, and we will be linking to them in our Facebook group.
So this all takes place in Australia in 1966 in Adelaide, the capital city of South Australia. Adelaide is the fifth most populous city in Australia. It has 1.4 million people living there, after Sydney, of course, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Perth. The city's name of the Kaurna people, I hope I pronounced that correctly, it's K-A-U-R-N-A, who originally inhabited the land, is Tantania, which means male red kangaroo rock, describing a rock formation. And no, unfortunately, the rock formation does not exist anymore. Apparently, the limestone was used to build the Parliament House and other older buildings in Adelaide, which is pretty sad because the rock formation was very important to the Kaurna people. This is a quote from an article titled They Should Expect a Little Bit of Truth that was published in City Mag on 6th of October 2022. Quote, in a time when emus and kangaroos roamed Tantania, now Adelaide Plains, in abundance, Tantania was a large rocky outcrop standing tall on the southern banks of Karawirapari River. This place was used by Kaurna Meyuna for the red kangaroo dreaming. The site was associated with secret Kaurna man's business, and this traditional knowledge from surrounding the area is today mostly complex and confidential. So says an Adelaide City Council management plan for the nearby park Tantania Woma. But the sandy limestone rock this important cultural site is made from was quarried and used to build colonized Adelaide. These bits of stone were most likely used to fortify and construct the old Parliament House in the 1840s. Now, the only physical reminder of the sacred place is what is on display at the front of the Adelaide Festival Centre. As part of the Kahuna Reconciliation Sculptures constellation, the limestone harks back to what once was. End quote. The article interviews an Aboriginal man named Elijah Bravington, who is a tour guide in Adelaide. And if you book a tour with him or his colleagues at the Southern Cultural Immersion, you will learn a lot about the Indigenous history of Adelaide. None of this has anything to do with our case, but as always, we are very interested in history of people and places, and it's always good to learn new things. So we will share the article, and if you're ever in Adelaide, maybe you remember the tours and book one. Alright, so let's continue. Just a tiny bit more of Adelaide history, I swear, just the basics. European settlers started to arrive in the Adelaide area in the first half of the 19th century, so around 1835. The official proclamation of the colony of South Australia took place on 28th of December 1836. The South Australian Company established in London was responsible for the development and planning of the new colony. Colonel William Light, a British surveyor, was tasked with choosing the site for the colony, and he selected the current location of Adelaide due to its proximity to the sea and the suitability of the surrounding land for agriculture. The settlement was founded as a free colony, distinct from the other Australian colonies that were primarily established as penal settlements. This attracted a diverse group of immigrants and contributed to the unique character and development of the city. And unfortunately, it only took a few decades to destroy most of the Kahuna culture. The last person fully descending from Kahuna died in 1929. Adelaide ranked as Australia's third largest city for most of the 20th century. The city saw significant progress during this time with the introduction of electric street lighting in 1900 and electric trams in operation by 1909. After World War I, Adelaide experienced a period of growth and relative prosperity. Its population expanded, and it became the country's third most populous metropolitan area following Sydney and Melbourne. However, this prosperity was short-lived due to recurring droughts and the impact of the Great Depression in the 1930s. Adelaide bounced back with effective government leadership, moving away from its heavy reliance on primary industries. The Playford government during World War II stimulated industrial growth and diversification in Adelaide, emphasizing its safer location for manufacturing. This period saw an expansion in shipbuilding at the nearby port. However, the Southern Australian government at that time overlooked cultural development, leading to an economic lag. The arrival of international manufacturers like General Motors Holden and Chrysler in suburbs around Adelaide, such as Elizabeth, marked the city's shift from an agricultural service hub to a modern motor city in the 20th century. Notable developments during this period included the Manum Adelaide pipeline, bringing River Murray water to Adelaide in 1955, and the opening of an airport in West Beach the same year. Flinders University and the Flinders Medical Center were established in the 1960s, significantly contributing to Adelaide's healthcare and the educational landscape. Flinders Medical Center remains one of South Australia's largest teaching hospitals today. So basically, the location of Adelaide had its pros and cons. The biggest pro was the location at the ocean, so the port was a very important one, but the biggest con were the droughts that the area often experienced. And after World War I, when the city experienced its biggest growth, many people moved to the area to seek employment in one of the new industries. And of course, these people and their families needed to live somewhere, and that's when the suburbs started to be established.
One of these Adelaide suburbs is called Somerton Park. And for most of you, the name Somerton probably rings a very loud bell because Somerton Park Beach is where a very famous John Doe was found in 1948, a decades-old mystery that was most likely finally solved in 2022. But that's a whole other episode if you want us to cover it. Somerton Beach is only a 25-minute walk from the house on Harding Street, and that is where the Beaumont family lived. Grant Alfred Beaumont was born on January 3, 1925, in Adelaide. And while his name was Grant, he was called Jim by everybody. During World War II, Jim was stationed in Borneo and participated in the Battle of Tarakan, where he was wounded by shrapnel. Tarakan is an island located off the east coast of Borneo, and the battle was part of the larger Borneo campaign designed to recapture the island of Borneo from Japanese forces. All of this information was new to me, so here's a little backstory. So, The battle for Tarakan began on May 1, 1945, with an assault by Australian forces against well-entrenched Japanese defenders. The island was strategically important due to its oil fields, which the Japanese had controlled since 1942. The Australians launched an amphibious invasion to reclaim the island. The battle was fiercely fought, characterized by intense jungle warfare as the Japanese forces had well-fortified positions and utilized elaborate defensive tactics. Despite the challenging conditions and determined resistance from the Japanese, the Australian forces managed to push forward, capturing key positions on the island. After about a month of heavy fighting, the Australians secured victory, and Tarakan was effectively in Allied hands by the end of June 1945. However, the cost of the battle was high, with significant casualties on both sides. The Battle of Tarakan was won in a series of operations leading to the eventual Allied victory in the Pacific Theater of World War II.
You saying that there was determined resistance of the Japanese soldiers immediately made me think of Hiro Onoda, the soldier who was hiding in the Philippine jungle until 1974, not realizing the war had ended.
Yeah, that was an incredibly moving story. We covered that in episode 58, Two Tales of Isolation.
So, Jim Beaumont was wounded and spent the rest of World War II, the Pacific Theater part of World War II, on an island in the Philippines. After the war, Jim was transferred to Japan as part of the occupation unit. And after he returned to Australia and was discharged from the military, he used the money he had saved to purchase a taxi, and he became a taxi driver. In 1955, so when Jim was 31 years old, he met a beautiful woman named Nancy Helen Ellis. Nancy was born on 5th of August 1927 in Adelaide as well, and I think at the time they met, Nancy had worked as a secretary for a meat manufacturer in Adelaide. The two hit it off right away, and the couple married in December of the same year. They purchased the house on Harding Street, right at the corner of Patterson Street, and it was a so-called war service home. I think war service homes became a thing in Australia after World War I already, but started to be more widespread after World War II. So these are pretty much affordable houses that veterans could purchase with the help of loans with lower interest rates.
The house they bought was a lovely, newly built home in a quiet Adelaide suburb, as we mentioned before, Somerton Park. The house had three bedrooms, with one bathroom and a beautiful yard for their future children. And it didn't take long until they welcomed their first child. Jane Natar was born on the 10th of September, 1956. 2 years later, on November 11th, 1958, their second daughter, Arna Kathleen, was born. And last but not least, their son, Grant Ellis, on the 12th of July, 1961. Now, the lovely home they purchased was filled with their children's laughter, and by all accounts, Nancy and Jim were very devoted parents who absolutely adored their children. Jim even changed career so that he was able to spend more time with his family. He sold his taxi and took a job working as a sales manager, which meant that he had to go on business trips, but overall, he had a much more stable work schedule, was home more than he was when he had been driving the taxi. And he also made more money, like more reliable money. Nancy had quit her job and was a stay-at-home mom, which was very much the norm back then, especially with three small children to take care of. In 1966, so when Jane was 9, Arna was 7, and Grant was 4, the two older children attended the Paringa Park Primary School. That was located just 1.2 miles or 2 kilometers from their home, and Grant was spending his days at home with his mum.
Friends and neighbors would later describe how living in the Australian suburb in the 1960s was kind of magical, and I can imagine it was pretty close to life in American suburbs at the time.
Sounds like, for sure. Especially, like, for some reason, Australia and California have very similar vibes to me.
Yeah, sounds like it, yeah. The houses were new, they were equipped with refrigerators and washing machines, and a car was in the driveway. There was lots of greens, there was nicely maintained yards, people were friendly, and everyone felt safe, and the kids were able to run around in the streets with their friends during weekends or summer break until the lights went on. I think we talked about it so many times before on this podcast. It was like this in many places in this world. Nobody was thinking of abducted or murdered children because these things simply didn't happen, quote unquote.
Right.
Until it did happen and the sense of security was destroyed and would never come back. And that's what happened in this case. Before the Beaumont children disappeared, parents in Australia didn't worry about their kids walking to school or riding their bike around the neighborhood or taking the bus to the beach. But actually, of course, that sense of safety is always false. Horrible things have always happened, also to children. Some of the more well-known cases in Australia were, for example, the murders of Ivy Mitchell or Chrissy Wren or Alma Tirchke, Graeme Thorne, we talked about this case already, Bertha Schippan, we talked about her story as well.
Mm-hmm.
And just a year prior, in 1965, two 15-year-old girls, Christine Sherrock and Marianne Schmidt, were raped and murdered on Wanda Beach in Sydney. So these things did happen. Those are all murdered children, many of the cases unsolved. I think the big difference with the Beaumont children, though, was that, first of all, it was three siblings disappearing at the same time, and we just don't know what happened to them. But what do we know? So it was the summer of 1966, Australian summer. We sometimes tend to forget that the Southern Hemisphere is the other way around, literally, when it comes to the seasons of the year. So from what I could figure out, summer break for Australian students is 6 weeks long and it starts on Christmas and it goes up until including Australia Day. So until the end of January. Australia Day takes place on 26th of January and it's the national holiday. The day commemorates the arrival of the first fleet at Port Jackson, which is Sydney Harbour, in 1788. This fleet, which consisted of 11 ships carrying British convicts, was led by Captain Arthur Phillip and marked the establishment of the British colony in Australia. While the arrival of the first fleet on 26th of January 1788 marked the formal beginning of the British colonization, the day's significance has evolved over time. And as it is the case with most colonized countries, this national holiday is also a bit of a complex subject with some debate and controversy surrounding it for many Indigenous Australians. The 26th of January represents the beginning of the dispossession of their land, the loss of their culture, the tragic consequences of colonization. Consequently, for some Indigenous people and their allies, this date is known as either Invasion Day or Survival Day, and they use it as a day of mourning and remembrance of the history of colonization and its impact on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people.
Yeah, it's not dissimilar, I think, to how many people feel in the United States about celebrating Columbus Day. I think learning all sides of history can be, for me anyway, can be sometimes very uncomfortable. But I don't personally enjoy being misinformed. I'd rather know the shitty truth and just accept it, you know? And it's just, it's all very complex.
Very complex. So complex, yeah. And discussion about the history is important. Otherwise, you can't acknowledge all of the history in a place and you wouldn't be able to change things to be a good representation for all the citizens of a nation, in my opinion.
Of course, absolutely.
All right. So it was school summer break 1966. As we said before, Jane, age 9, Arna, 7, and Grant, 4, have spent many days at their favorite beach, Glen Elk Beach. Glen Elk Beach is roughly 3 kilometers or 1.8 miles from the Beaumont home, so just a little further than Jane's and Arna's school would have been. Glen Elk was and still is a popular coastal destination for locals and tourists alike. And don't forget, it's the early to mid-60s and that was the height of the surfer craze. As a Beach Boys fan, I feel obligated to mention that.
Yeah, you gotta.
Now, I don't think there is a whole lot of surfing going on in Glen Elk Beach. I don't think that was a good surfer spot. But, you know, the whole lifestyle was pretty popular. You know, the wearing of the bushy, bushy blonde hairdo and Huarache sandals. And Glen Elk Beach was one of the places to be with the relaxed and vibrant atmosphere. People would spend time on the sandy shores. They would enjoy picnics, sunbathing, swimming, playing beach games. There was even an amusement park, the Magic Mountain Amusement Park, that opened in 1963, and all of that became a major attraction. There's also an esplanade along the beachfront that features shops and cafes and restaurants, and it creates this lively and bustling atmosphere. So it was a place for locals and visitors to socialize, shop and dine. The 1960s marked a period of relative peace and prosperity in Australia, and places like Glenelg Beach epitomized the leisurely lifestyle that many Australians enjoyed during this era. And I'm sure Jane, Arna and Grant were absolutely thrilled to be able to spend as much time as possible there. The three kids would ride their bikes there, or their dad would drop them off, and by themselves they would spend a fun day at the beach and return home at the agreed upon time. The three kids had been to the beach several times during that summer in 1966, and at one point Arna even teased her older sister in front of their mom by saying, "Jane has a boyfriend at the beach, Jane has a boyfriend at the beach." And Nancy didn't think too much of it. She probably thought that Jane had made friends with a boy her age at the beach, and she didn't inquire further. We will definitely come back to that next week.
Yeah. On the 25th of January, the day before Australia Day, Jim took the three children to the beach, and then he was off to a sales appointment in the countryside, so he would be spending that night out of town. He dropped the kids off at Glenelg and watched them walking toward the beach. One last wave goodbye, and he drove off. He couldn't possibly fathom that this was the last time he would see his three children. Not much else happened that day. The kids returned home from the beach, Nancy served them dinner, and when it was time, they went to bed. Early the next morning, Arna and Grant started pestering Nancy by asking if they could go to the beach again. It was Australia Day, after all, and there would be lots going on at Glenelg. Nancy wasn't really sure if she should send them. It was supposed to be a really, really hot day. She thought about going to the beach with them, but she had a lot to do, and the thought of three energetic kids in the house on a beautiful day wasn't really great either. So she allowed it, but she asked them to be home in time for lunch. As it was supposed to be so hot that day, around 40 degrees Celsius or 105 Fahrenheit, she told the kids to take the bus and leave their bikes at home. So Nancy handed Jane 8 shillings and 6 pence, and that would pay for the bus fare both ways and for lunch. I think Jane was supposed to bring some things back from the bakery for lunch so that Nancy could have lunch with the kids. They'd all eat together at home. Jane put the money in a little purse and packed it in her bag together with 3 towels and a book. Jane was wearing a one-piece bathing suit, which was pink, with green shorts and tartan canvas shoes. Arna was wearing a one-piece bathing suit as well. Hers was red, with tan shorts and tan sandals, and in her hair she had a bright orange hair clip. Grant was wearing green and white swim trunks, with green shorts over and red sandals. He was not wearing a shirt. Around 10 a.m., Jane, Arna, and Grant left their home and walked up to Diagonal Road, where they took the bus to Glenelg Beach. It was a short ride, only 10 to 15 minutes tops. All we know about the children's movements after that comes from several eyewitness reports. When the children arrived at their destination, they got off the bus and encountered an acquaintance, their mailman. Jane excitedly said, "It's the postie," and the children greeted them. So the mailman was one witness. The next witness was an elderly couple sitting at a bench with a view of the beach, a young man visiting Adelaide with his family, as well as a mother with her young daughter. They reported that the children dropped off their stuff at the beach and walked, or probably ran, into the shallow water. Jane always made sure that Grant would only go into the water up to his belly. They splashed around in the water for a little while and then ran to retrieve their stuff and place their towels in the shade under some pine trees. All these witnesses reported seeing a man laying on his towel watching the Beaumont children. The children then ran over to the sprinklers where they played, washing the seawater off and just having a good time for a little while. Then they returned to their towels. Jane, Arna, and Grant walked over to the man on his towel and they started talking to him. The way they talked made it look as if they knew each other. The kids even started to tease the man a little bit, jumping over him and flicking their towels at him.
I always wondered, these are very detailed witness reports, and we know how it is with eyewitness reports, right? I wonder why they paid so much attention to the group of 4, like a man and 3 children. And if they acted so familiar with him, they must have appeared to be a dad and his kids, or an uncle and his nieces and nephew. And I'm sure there were like dozens of similar groups like them at the beach that day. Why pay so much attention to them? I don't think the witnesses ever said that the man gave up any creepy vibes or that they had an uneasy feeling while watching. Do you think because the kids were, from what I can see in photos, they were kids with these great smells and looked like, you know, I don't know, fun kids overall, like these open, friendly faces.
I don't know. I mean, I think that it does look like they were incredibly happy kids, but you do wonder why people would have paid particular attention to this group with somebody's lizard brain pinging a little bit about something, you know? All right, so witnesses see the kids playing with this man, and after a while, he gets up and he goes to the park bench where the elderly couple is sitting. And apparently he has his clothes there, and he asks the couple if they saw anybody messing with his clothes, or did you see anyone messing with our clothes? We had some money taken, that kind of thing, insinuating that someone had stolen money from him and the kids, which again makes it sound as if he's there with the kids, or at least he wants other people to think that he is there with the kids, with his kids, right? So then he returned to Jane, Arna, and Grant, and he started dressing them. Another witness saw the three kids standing on the lawn talking to the man around 12 p.m., so that's the time when they would have been expected back home. The four then walked off in the opposite direction of the kids' bus stop toward the changing rooms. Around 12:10, the kids were seen outside of the changing rooms as if they were waiting for someone. And the last we know of Jane, Arna, and Grant is that around 12:30, they walked into Wenzel's Bakery on Mosley Street. The bakery existed since 1938, and it was somewhat famous among beachgoers. The kids went there often enough to buy some snacks while at the beach, so salespeople knew them and would remember them. That day, the kids bought 2 bottles of fizzy drinks, 5 pasties, 6 finger buns, and 1 meat pie. They had never bought a meat pie before that day.
I think, and I saw that in a documentary, and I read it in several sources, but not in all of them. So I don't know if it's really actual from a witness statement. But what was said in the documentary was that the sales clerk who knew the kids said that Jane and the children said that they bought the pie for the man.
Oh, right. Yeah. That is interesting. Another weird thing was that Jane paid with a £1 note. So where did that bill come from? I mean, obviously it must have been the man because Nancy didn't give it to her. And that was a lot of money back in the day, especially for a child to have.
Fun fact, 2.5 weeks later, on 14th of February 1966, on the so-called conversion day, Australia changed its currency to Australian dollars. Just in case that some of you were wondering why we are talking about pounds and pence and shillings here. Now, as for the worth of the money, people who were around at the time said it was an unusual amount of money, especially for a little girl to have. I tried the inflation calculator, but I don't know why I got several different results from it being worth somewhat from 10 euros to 30 euros in nowadays money. So that didn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't know. I also read somewhere that at the time £1 would have been what you would earn with a day's work on average. And that today the average daily wage would be around 140 US dollars. So that would make a whole lot more sense for it being too much for Jane to have. And the most important part is she didn't have that money on her, just as Annie said. She didn't have the money with her when she left the house. So it's safe to assume that the man gave it to her. And the most important part, this was the last time anyone saw Jane, Arna, and Grant. After that, it was as if they had just vanished without a trace. Now back home at Harding Street, Nancy was doing her household chores that late morning. And when it turned 12 o'clock, Nancy got on her bike and rode the short distance to greet the children at the bus stop. But the bus came and left and the children were nowhere to be seen. Okay, that can happen. Kids at the beach, they didn't pay attention to the time, they missed the bus. They will be on the next bus, the one that arrives an hour later. Nothing to worry. Nancy returned home and soon after, some family friends had come by for a cup of coffee and a quick chat. At 1 p.m., Nancy kept looking out the window, waiting for her children to arrive. But again, they didn't come. Now she probably started to feel uneasy, you know, this kind of bad feeling you get in your stomach when you think something is wrong. Nancy told herself that everything was okay, they were just late. So she waited until 2 p.m. for the next bus. And when the kids didn't arrive, she started to panic. Her friends offered her to drive her over to Glenelg to look for the children. but Nancy was worried that they had decided to walk back home and that she would miss them if she left now. She decided to wait for the next bus. And shortly before 3 p.m., Jim arrived home early. Nancy immediately told him that the children were not home yet, and Jim got right back in his car and drove over to the beach looking for Jane, Arna, and Grant. He drove around the streets, he parked his car and walked up and down the area he knew they most liked to play, but he couldn't find them anywhere. He returned home, hoping that the kids had shown up at the house by now, but of course they hadn't. Nancy got in the car with him, and together they kept driving around Glenelg, looking for the three. Around 7 p.m., they gave up the search and went to Glenelg police station, where they reported the three children missing.
Every parent's worst nightmare.
Now, let me make one thing absolutely clear. Sending three young kids of that age alone to the beach might sound shocking and irresponsible for many of us today, but it was absolutely normal at the time. Nobody would have thought anything of it. Hell, I didn't live close to the beach, but I remember at 9 years old during summer break, my friend from school and I would ride our bikes to the next town over to spend the day at the public pool without any parental supervision. And that was the late 80s, and it was absolutely standard. Annie, you grew up near the ocean. Your sister and you alone at the beach? Was that something?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We had rules about swimming because the beach we went to had no lifeguards, unlike this beach, which was always, whether or not there were lifeguards, this was a very popular beach. You would not find yourself completely alone on it, you know, like where we grew up. But yeah, here to confirm that this was totally normal also in the USA in the 80s. And I think also I want to point out that one of the things that for me is so upsetting about this case is I think that you, me, and Jane also have in common that we're sort of firstborn daughters of above average intelligence who were sort of precocious enough to navigate these situations, you know, with our siblings or other younger children. This was totally the norm as children. And I also want to point out that living this life, I never felt neglected or not carefully watched as a child. I think my parents were actually very much stricter than most. This was just normal, healthy behavior at the time. Yeah, we're not judging anyone. So don't think like, oh my goodness, this lady never should have let her kids, you know, no biggie.
This was absolutely no biggie, no big deal at the time. The parents were not neglectful, they were naive. It was absolutely normal that the kids were allowed to go to the beach unsupervised. They did it all the time. And I don't think at the time anyone thought Jim and Nancy were bad parents. I mean, maybe some did, but I think overall parents were like, this could have happened to us. This could have been us.
That's right. It's very reminiscent for me of the Adam Walsh case in the United States. This was sort of Australia's Adam Walsh, which happened much before. Yeah.
I also had to think a lot about Walter Collins. I mean, that happened way before in the United States, the Wineville Chicken Coop. But she went to work and she told her son, you stay home. If there's any problem, go and get the neighbor.
Yeah, it's awful.
And honestly, at that point, when they then went to the police station around 7 p.m., nobody thought about the kids being possibly abducted.
No.
I think not even Nancy and Jim thought of that. I'm sure they thought that the kids were either at a friend's house, or that they must have had some sort of an accident, right? But what kind of an accident? Three kids drowning at the same time at a beach full of people is possible. Did they enter one of the storm drains and couldn't make it out in time? Had they dug a cave in the sand and it collapsed onto them? That's the kind of things I think they were, you know, imagining.
Yeah, or like something Arna fell and maybe she broke an ankle. You know, they can't leave the little one with her because she can't move, like that kind of thing, where they're just stuck waiting somewhere for someone to figure out where they are to sort everything out, you know?
So a police car was sent to Harding Street to talk to the neighbors and friends. If they have an idea where the kids could be, search troops were formed and police cars were driving around the Adelaide suburbs, loudspeakers on the roof of the cars, asking for information and telling the people to be on the lookout for the three children. After 2 days of the children being missing and the eyewitnesses coming forward telling that they saw the kids with a man, the horrible realization sank in that they might have been taken by a stranger. So everyone is out there searching, not only the authorities on land. I think they even, how do you say that, the harbor at Glen Elk Beach, the boat harbor, they kind of dried it or pumped the water out, and then they were knee deep in the mud and looking for the children there.
Oh,
so they looked everywhere.
Yeah.
So everyone is out there searching, not only the authorities, they were on land, on water, they used helicopters, but also private citizens are trying to aid. And while the Beaumont children could not be found, two 16-year-old girls discovered the heavily decomposed body of a man buried in the sand who had been shot in the head 3 times. This, of course, had nothing to do with the disappearance of the children, but I think it's still interesting and worth noting.
Yeah, those poor girls, my God. It happens a lot, doesn't it, that you find remains when you're searching for other remains, right?
Does it?
Yeah. I always think of like Long Island serial killer or haven't there been cases where they were looking for someone but found someone else? You know, that kind of, I feel like that happens every so often. Not like...
I never heard it about happening here in Austria, but we have not a lot of unsolved murder cases, so...
And again, I'm probably thinking in my mind that it happens way more frequently than it really happens. But when it does happen, it always gives me a little bit of the goosebumps and feels like a sign to me, you know? Yeah. Like, I feel like if you're looking for a potential murdered person and you find another murdered person, you're going to tell me that's coincidence. My husband would say, yeah, it is coincidence.
How many murdered missing people are out there?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And Paul would know immediately. He'd tell me what the probability is and laugh at me for, you know, thinking it's rare, but it definitely gives me the goosebumps every time. But yeah, everyone was on the lookout. The media reported every new development, but unfortunately, some of the things that were reported were not actually correct. For example, at first it was believed that the last person to see the kids was the mailman, and that he had seen them at a time when they were already supposed to have taken the bus home, so around noon. But that seems to have been a mix-up or misinformation, because it looks like, from what we know now, as if the postie had seen the kids when they first arrived, which was shortly after 10 a.m. Another misleading thing was the description of the mystery man that was seen in the company of the children. At first, he was reported as being sort of a surfer dude, blonde hair that, quote, needed a haircut, thin with a suntan.
It was in so many articles in the beginning. He looked like he needed a good haircut, and that's such a 50s, 60s thing to say.
It's literally the photograph of my dad. Like, when I was first brought home, there's a picture of my dad holding me, and every time he sees it, because I have it framed, he's like, I hate that picture, I need a haircut. He's like, I look like a hippie. Not that he actually has any problem with hippies, it's just not his. You know, he was an army guy. But yeah, this sounds like something my parents would say. So just picture that guy, you know, thin, suntan, kind of suspicious looking. And that's what people looked for just way too long, unfortunately, way too long. Because in reality, what was agreed upon by most of the eyewitnesses was that the suspect was a, quote, tall man with fair to light brown hair and a thin face in his mid-30s. This man had a suntanned complexion and a thin to athletic build, and he was wearing swim trunks, end quote. He was described as an Australian. I think a lot of, at that time, there were a lot of European immigrants, many from Germany coming to Australia. So I think what that meant was that this man was not a first-generation immigrant, but had an Australian accent. What else? His hair was not in need of a haircut at all, but quite the opposite. It was short, combed back, and parted on one side. He was described as having a slim face and that he didn't look suspicious at all. Not even remotely like what you would describe as like a dirty old man or a dirty hippie or like a sus surfer guy. Like, none of that.
And we will talk about more of that next week.
Yeah.
But I think it's getting a little bit better nowadays, the awareness that evil people don't have to look what you think is evil, but
quite on the contrary,
most of the time. They can blend in very well and you would never suspect.
All the best killers do. That's how they...
Yeah, exactly.
That's how they catch their prey,
But
right?
I think the awareness was just not there yet in the 1960s.
Oh, 100%. Absolutely agree. This was very much a time all over the world where a book was judged by its cover.
Yeah.
And so, you know, listen, that made things better and worse for all manner of people for all kinds of different reasons. One witness described him as having a, quote, crazy walk with his arms bowed like an ape, end quote.
You know what that sounds like to me?
Muscle man.
Yes, exactly that. If he was athletic, and you know how this man, and that's also, again, something that we see in a lot of movies from the 40s to the 60s, where it's like chest out.
Oh, yeah. Well, we talked about Mickey Hargitay, right? Was that for Patreon when we were talking about Mariska and Mickey Hargitay? And that, like, old-fashioned bodybuilder. That's what I pictured. Yeah. Narrow waist, big muscles.
Yeah. And the arms.
The arms, like a little bit bent and out.
Yeah, I can exactly. I think that's what she saw.
That makes sense. Absolutely. Absolutely. And then the eyewitness also said that they didn't see a bag on him or keys or anything like that. Did they see him carrying Jane's bag, though, or is that, are we going to talk about that next week?
Well, the thing with Jane's bag, she had a bag where she had the towels in, and she had like an off-white or beige clip purse where she had put the money in, right? And apparently when the kids were at the bakery, they didn't have their bags or the belongings with them.
Yeah.
Not the clip purse, not the towels, not the bag, nothing. So where was that?
Right.
And again, we're going to talk about it more next week. But that's something to keep in the back of your head, yeah. I read that he carried the bag, but also I think that just came from one source and I'm not so sure because that's the only time I ever read that.
That's the thing I struggle with the most with this case is just the different eyewitnesses and what we know today about how terrible. This isn't an indictment against any of the witnesses. We just know factually that witness testimony is very unreliable.
That's what I'm thinking about the bakery, for example.
Yeah. How do they know for sure what they're remembering? And if they knew the kids, I wouldn't be 100% sure that I could say what they ordered that day, or if they were there all the time, would I be merging memories?
Thing. Like, I get that they remember the kids because they were there regularly. Yeah. They knew the name of the kids. I can see that they remember a one-pound note because that's kind of
a
weird
lot for a kid to have.
A lot. But to remember, well, they ordered 2 tall bottles of fizzy drink and 5, what was it, 5?
5 pasties and 6 finger buns
and a meat pie.
Maybe they did know, though.
Maybe I'm just the worst eyewitness ever, because I wouldn't be able to remember anything, like seriously.
What I wonder, and I don't, you know, this is probably maybe next week instead, but that order also, if it is correct, really lines up with a situation where the kids think this is somebody who knows their parents, and now he's saying, well, let's go to the bakery, and I'll go with you to your mother's for lunch. Come to my car, and let's get what your mother wanted, which would maybe be those 5 pasties. That would be 4 pasties for each of them, plus 1 for this new friend of theirs.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
And bring me a pie.
Exactly. Exactly. And let's get a nice meat pie. And then that was it. And especially since we know the children had been there before and they seemed like they kind of, it could just be the simplest thing as he was there regularly. He made a point to be near them often when they were there. They see him around them regularly when they're at the beach. So he becomes kind of a fixture at the beach. He strikes up a quick conversation. Oh, I know your mom. I know your mummy. I know your daddy. I work with dad. You know, whatever it is.
And
you're
in. I honestly think that they knew each other already.
You think so? It's possible.
Yes, because, I mean, again, we talk about it more next week, but
Jane was shy. She was shyer than I was as a kid. It wouldn't have been easy to take her in.
They were all shy.
Yeah.
Nancy and Jim were shocked that they would talk to a stranger that they never met before.
Yeah.
And what was the most shocking to them is that the man, the mystery man, helped to dress the kids.
Yes.
Nancy said Jane would have never allowed that as far as she could imagine it.
Right.
So they must have known each other,
which makes it so much worse. It's like, what's worse? It's someone that your kids actually know. It's someone who stalked your kids, who watched your kids for such a long time.
I think he made friends with them and made them feel like they could trust him.
Of course.
I think the whole missing money, I think he took Jane's money.
I agree.
To get a reason for them to... he would need to help them. Well, I can give you money for the bus.
Yeah, of course. Of course I'll help you, you know. Yeah. We have so much to talk about next week.
We will circle back to all of that, yeah, when we get next week into the investigation, the theories, the suspects. It's a lot.
It's a lot. Do you have anything good?
Do you have some... Yes, I have something good, but it's going to become annoying for our listeners. Okay, it's the last time. Maybe not the last time. But I did it. I ran 5K.
I'm so proud of you.
You know, that was one of my goals. And I was struggling so much. It was so hard. And then one day I just did it. And guess what? The last week in total, I ran 19 kilometers in four or five runs. And most of them for fun. Like, it was not even a training schedule on that day. And I was like, I could run for half an hour.
Oh, that's good.
It's getting to the point where I run for fun. Like, what is
Look
happening?
Look at you running for fun. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, I'm very happy about it, honestly. Very
that's
proud.
That's amazing. I'm proud of you.
Thank you. How about you? What's your something good?
I just recently visited the most wonderful alpaca farm. This isn't an ad. Like, no one's paying me anything. Just genuine info for our listeners, because I know a lot of people are in the New England area. So we went to Granite State Alpacas in New Hampshire recently when my cousin was visiting, and just met the absolute sweetest alpacas. And I also bought some beautiful yarn there. One thing I really want to do in the new year, like ever since I got this ADHD diagnosis, it's wild. It's like, I know I keep mentioning it, but I can't even tell y'all how shooketh I am by all of this. It's like, so much makes sense. And I'm having all the feels. But one thing I really want to do in the new year is to find time to pick up my knitting needles again. I want to try to put devices mostly away after dinner and stop sort of breaking my brain. So I'm going to try knitting more. And there are few fibers as delightful to work with as alpaca. It's if you knit or crochet or weave or do anything with fiber, then you know that, you know, treating yourself to good yarn is a delight. It makes the whole experience that much nicer. So anyway, you should think, Johanna, about what I can make you for your birthday. That something I can make, though, like just like a hat, a scarf, a blanket, a shawl, because I've never actually made a sweater.
I always love scarves.
Scarves?
I always need scarves.
Mm-hmm. All right. Tell me the kind of colors and size you want, and I'll make you a scarf. But yeah, as long as I don't have to sew pieces together or get measurements just right, because I cannot. But yeah, if you're local and you want a farm tour, go check out granitestatealpacas.com, and you'll find all of the information you need. I think they've just actually stopped their regular farm tours, but I think they do still offer some of them. They're free of charge. So sign up for their newsletter and they'll keep you posted. And please also, if you visit them, don't buy the rest of the yarn that's on sale before I have a chance to. But yeah, dryer balls, which are, I've been using wool dryer balls forever, and I want to get some of her alpaca dryer balls. Socks, yarn, all kinds of things on their website. And also, if you enjoy alpacas, their Instagram is amazing, Granite State Alpacas. So go check them out. Tell them we said hi. I'll post some pictures of our visit on Instagram and tag the podcast when I do. But it was just a really good, fun day out, and I wanted to tell you all about it.
I think that's it, right?
I think that's everything.
If you enjoyed this episode or any of our other episodes, please go to your favorite podcast app and see if you can leave us a rating and or review. We extremely appreciate all of them, but the most surprising ones for us are the ones who leave us a bad review, and then after month and month of listening to us, they come back and change the review to something really nice, which is really...
Yeah, thanks, Simca. We appreciate
the best.
It. You, yeah, Simca, if you're listening, you honestly had my favorite negative review, which was, if I could care less about Henry VIII, I would be dead. Like, I feel you.
You have no idea how often we say that.
All the time. We're going to put it on a t-shirt, I think. And no, you're not going to get one for free.
And what else? Please visit our webpage for everything else. There you find the link to our Patreon, our merch store, our PO box, our email. Apropos Patreon, our Murder Tier get-together is going to be on the 30th of November. Also, we're going to record the next Tell Me Everything next week. No, this weekend, right?
This weekend, yep. We've got a couple of exciting episodes lined up for that, so I'm really looking forward to it.
And that's it, I think. Please tell your pets who said hi. Love them, hug them, cuddle them, give them treats. Everybody, say hi to Tallulah and his surprise foster dog.
Uh-huh.
Treat all the pets and animals out there nicely.
That's right.
Be kind to them. Be kind to your fellow human beings and be kind to yourself. And I know it's hard, but you gotta do it.
You really, really do. And just remember, as Churchill said back in World War II, if you're going through hell,
keep going. Tschüss.
Bye.